Welcome to Beyond the Spotlight. I'm Dot Cannon. Behind every great film, book, or play is a craft in which my guest today excels. Travis Edward Pike is quite possibly America's greatest living storyteller, and he's also a musician, an animator, poet, producer, all-round Renaissance man and arts person, and I hope I haven't forgotten anything.
If you have, we'll get to it later.
Okay, good. You scared me. Well, Travis, welcome to Beyond the Spotlight.
Well, thank you for having me, Dot. It's a real pleasure.
And what we're going to be focusing on this afternoon is A Flight of Fancy, a medieval fantasy adventure that you made a major project 2 years ago and which is now in production as, if I'm not mistaken, a feature film.
And not quite yet. We're working on that. If we can get the financials done, I'll call you. We'll make a big announcement.
That sounds wonderful. And what's unusual about this, by the way, the work is entitled Grumpus, is that this is a story told entirely in rhyme, which you did at Blenheim Palace in 1997, and not exactly as a one-man show, but almost. How did you come to choose the medium that you chose, presenting it as a storyteller and playing all the parts, excepting for the queen and the waifs?
Well, it all snuck up on me from behind.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we decided to do Grumpus in a live venue because, frankly, the feature motion picture is going to be extraordinarily expensive. So how could we introduce it? How could we get the public to become aware of this wonderful tale in such a way so that by the time we got around to spending all that big money on a feature film, they'd be anticipating it? I want Grumpus to be as well known as Pinocchio before we roll a camera. So the answer was, we'll get some great actor and we'll go stage it live somewhere and we'll shoot the thing as a storytelling event and it'll be just like the bards of old. We'll have a poet philosopher come out and just nail this thing and the audience will go crazy and everyone will see that this form is still exciting in this age. Well, that was the plan. But it didn't exactly play out that way because every actor I spoke to said, are you out of your mind? I'm not going to memorize a 99-minute rhyme. Actors today, they're just not like they used to be. They like to turn the camera off and go have a break.
Which, of course, because you wound up being the main show, you didn't get to do that, really. You didn't get to go have a break.
The funniest part of that is I also directed. And I'm on stage, under the rock, waiting for the show to start, while the fairy queen comes out and she throws the ball out for the kids. We had these wonderful rhythmic gymnasts from Coventry. I love these little kids. They were great. And they did this to help save the children. And Save the Children, of course, is a world-famous organization that does just that. It runs around the world wherever there are catastrophes and wars and does everything possible to alleviate the suffering of the children and, of course, get them back with their parents and what have you. So anyway, there we are. We're going to do the show. I'm under the rock. The show begins. How can I know what's happening? I can't see. I'm under a rock. So finally, we get to the part where I crawl out from under the rock. I say hello to the fairy queen. She curses me and leaves. And there I am, alone, on that stage. And I never got to come off once. It never occurred to me that by playing the bard, both asleep on the rock or under the rock, I never got off stage. It was horrifying when the final moment came. It was like, is this over? Did I make it all the way to the end? But it was a thrilling and exciting experience. And we did do it at Blenheim Palace, which is a very exciting venue. It's the birthplace of Sir Winston Churchill and home of the 11th Duke of Marlborough. And I can say that now. Isn't that wonderful?
That certainly is. Now, Grumpus had the seeds of way back when. This is a medieval fairy tale. It was also something that I suspect that when you wrote it, you never perceived what it was going to be.
No. Basically, I wrote this for my 5-year-old daughter. She's really my stepdaughter, although that's been so long ago that we don't think of it that way. But when I first had her, when she first became mine, she was distant and quiet and sweet, but just there was no connection. I would come in the room and she'd be quiet. Well, that, of course, doesn't work for me. I'm not that kind of a guy. So I made a real effort to try to win her over. One of the things she loved, even when she was quiet, is if I was performing or rehearsing my music or something, she would sit and watch just with these big, big eyes, listening and seeming to love every bit of it. So I began telling her some of my little rhymes and stories, and she loved them. So I wrote Grumpus with her in mind. I mean, the idea was, here's this kind of grumpy little kid now trying to get her to come out of her shell. And so I talked about her like a cat because, you know, she definitely wasn't a puppy dog kind of a kid. She was a far more aloof and independent kind of a child. Well, in the end, Grumpus was a delight. We had a lot of fun with it, and it kept getting bigger and bigger, and it was fine with us. And that was the end of it. I mean, we got to be great friends and still are to this day. However, a few years back, when one of our film projects didn't happen, this is kind of a common occurrence in this industry, I noticed, you know, coming up to the end of the year, we had nothing that we could point to that said we did anything that year, and she said, why don't you do Grumpus? Now, this is my grown-up daughter. She says, why don't you finish Grumpus? Because I'd come up with a great ending and everything, and it meant that I'd have to do some rewriting or what have you. So I thought about it, and I said, yeah, that's a great idea. That'd probably take me all of, you know, 2 or 3 days. It took 2 or 3 months just to write it. And I did another terrible thing. I did such a rewrite, because I really now was crafting it for the public, for the world, that things that I had known for years, I changed, and I changed them subtly. And in doing so, I shot myself in both feet, because every time I would start, I'd go off on one of those tangents from the old days, and I'd have to be dragged back to, no, now you say it, oh my goodness. But it was still and all a wonderful project. It is the project that brought my daughter and I together in a way that has been wonderful ever since. So when she asked Daddy to do Grumpus, well, what could I do?
Really, you really didn't have that much of a choice there. And an interesting note is that your daughter had a special role in the production of Grumpus, too.
That's even more spectacular. We were over in England, we're getting ready to do the show, and we had some financial difficulties. This was an expensive project. So I needed to be up north rehearsing the kids, and I had my DP, the director of photography, come over to supervise the building of the theater. We built a theater for a one-night stand at Blenheim Palace. So he was tied up. Well, who was going to handle the hiring of the crew and getting all the equipment together and all that sort of thing? Well, there's only one person I know with that kind of skill and quality that works that well with me. So I called my daughter, and she took a leave of absence from CB Commercial, and the next thing you know, she was in England, and she was the production coordinator. So it was a wonderful, wonderful thing, and it was a joy to work with her.
It would be fun, too, and I promise our audience a treat right now. Later on in this show, we're going to get you to give us a little taste of what that audience heard. But would you start your story for me at the beginning as far as your story as a storyteller and artist goes? Take me back to the very early days back in Boston. You are originally from Boston and were originally both a musician and the son of somebody who got paid to do something that probably enhanced your creativity.
Yes, my dad was not only the movie director and programming director for WNAC-TV in Boston, but he was one of the people who was part of bringing motion pictures to television. And so he would screen everyone lovingly because, of course, he had to make sure that they met the code and that they didn't say anything in the movies on TV that they shouldn't, because he was very conscious of the fact that this image was going right into people's living rooms. And he didn't want to put in anything that would offend them, so he very carefully arranged to have them cut just right. He even laid in the commercials lovingly at natural places where the story's going to skip another 2 weeks or something, so you wouldn't notice it as much. He was a great fellow, still is. And well, the good part of that is that I used to get my friend from next door, and we would sit downstairs in the screening room, and we got to watch all these hundreds and hundreds of great old movies. And that was, you know, as long as we were quiet and didn't interfere in any way. You want to talk about two little kids who never said a word, because we didn't even have a television in those days. So even though the movies were going on television, and my father worked in the television industry, if I wanted to see the movies, I saw them in the screening room with my friend from next door. And it was great.
Oh, what heaven that sounds like for two small boys.
Well, the other thing that's a little funny is all of them were in black and white. because they were all 16 millimeter, especially for television. And so as I grew up and began my own video collection, all of a sudden I was seeing these movies in color. I said, oh, they've colorized it. And I'd look carefully at the titles, and it said it was in Technicolor. I said, oh, I see. It wasn't so much that this movie was colorized as that the version I saw when I was a kid was in black and white.
All of a sudden, The Wizard of Oz has color, and where did that come from,
right?
Right.
And I honestly thought at first, well, they've been ruining all these great classic movies.
Now, your first literary effort, you mentioned on your website, was met with something less than success.
Well, I didn't understand the concept of a study hall. A study hall sounded like something that belonged to me, right? If you're not actually in class doing something under an instructor, and you just have time of your own, well, that sounds like time of your own. And I was very fortunate. I'd done very well in grammar school, and I'd started at Boston Latin School, which is a fabulous school. In its day, and perhaps today for all I know, but in its day it was considered just about the best school in the entire country. And they only took the creme de la creme, and I fooled them, and I got in. So there I was. I was in this school, and it was a study hall, and I began writing stories. I was so excited by all the things I was learning in this very adult school. I mean, I went to college for a little while, too. And I have to tell you that college was not as tough as Boston Latin School, and I didn't learn as much either.
Wow.
But we'll get, that's a different story. Back to Boston Latin School. There I am, writing a story, working diligently, and an instructor who I guess was sort of just a monitor to make sure that nobody got into trouble or talked or something, came up behind me and seized my efforts. He seized my literary efforts, and he looked at them, and he saw that they had absolutely nothing to do with any schoolwork, and he gave me 5 misdemeanor marks. Well, my goodness, misdemeanor marks are a bad thing, and frankly, I think if you got 6, that resulted in a censure, and a censure could even get you kicked out of school.
Wow. Well,
this is a big deal. Talk about getting your creativity stomped upon.
I couldn't understand that either, looking at your website. What was so bad about writing a story that had absolutely nothing to do with the curriculum? I didn't get it.
I don't get it either, to be perfectly honest. Never did. It seemed to me that what they apparently wanted was that you would do your homework. But if you do your homework, isn't that supposed to be done at home?
I would think so. That's kind of within the definition of homework here.
Mind you, after that, I didn't do homework either, so...
You do say on the website you pursued your own curriculum.
I did. And it was a good one, apparently. I mean, I've gotten all the way to here so far. Not too bad. The thing is that I was a bright kid, and I had interests. I mean, when people start teaching you these new things, things you've never heard of, and I had an older brother, Jimmy, who would come home and tell me stories of the things he was learning 3 grades ahead of me. And boy, were they exciting. So I would read his books. I wasn't doing his homework, but I was reading his books instead of my books. Oh, no, it was terrible. I got in all kinds of trouble.
Sounds like fun trouble, though.
Oh, it was.
When did you first realize that you had the ability to captivate an audience? Was that through your storytelling or your musical efforts?
It was the music, and that came from outer space. I was a kid. We just moved out of Roxbury in downtown Boston, what they call the combat zone, as a matter of fact. And we moved to Newton, which is sort of like moving from Watts, I guess, to Beverly Hills.
Wow.
Which is, you know, quite a change of scene in every way.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very much an outsider and pretty much kept to myself. And I, you know, did pursue my studies, but of course they were my studies by then. I was studying animation. I was studying all kinds of exciting things, history, mythology, all those things that really just fired me when I was a kid. So, out of nowhere, some guys drove up to the school. This is in the days before when guys drove up to your school, you had to duck. You know, this is when guys drove up to your school and they said hi, you said hi back. You didn't have to run in terror.
The good old days.
Yeah. Well, they said that they'd heard I was a singer. Now, I don't know where they got that idea. I had never said it. I don't know anybody that had ever heard me sing or anything of that kind. Now, true, like every kid my age, I guess I was about 14 or so, I had a record player, and I bought records. And I stood up in my room all by myself, bellowing away at the record player, I guess. And for all I know, somebody had gone by and heard me and told these kids, if you're looking for a singer, the kid in that house sings. I don't know how it came about. Never did find out because it didn't become important. But they asked if I was interested in joining their band. Well, this was an outreach, wasn't it? This was somebody saying you could belong to something. So I said, well, sure, you know, we'll go see how it works. And I went, and these kids were from like two towns away. And they drove me out there to where they rehearsed. And we rehearsed, you know what a rehearsal was? What songs do you know? And they'd tell me what they knew, and I'd tell them what I know. And then, oh, we know that one. And so they'd play it, and I'd say, oh, I can't sing it in that key. Or they, I don't know anything from keys. They kept changing keys until they found one I liked. And all we did is, all the rehearsal was finding what key I sang songs in, and then writing a list. And they were in desperate need of a singer because they had a gig coming up. And the gig was at a sock hop at a Catholic church in a little town. Well, I don't think it's a little town anymore, but between Newton and Natick, Massachusetts, is the bustling metropolis of Needham. And they were going to have a sock hop. And the deal was, now this is going to make me sound like I'm a dinosaur, but in those days it was a big deal even to get gas money. Mm-hmm. One of these kids, the oldest kid, who was the drummer, had access to his mother's station wagon. Without which, of course, there would have been no band, because right. Nobody could get together. So he packed all his drums, that's why he needed the station wagon, and then the couple of guitars and what have you, and he picked everybody up, and he took us out to this place in Needham, where we were to perform the sock hop. And the deal was, Father, whoever he was going to give him $5 for gas money. It wasn't like we were getting paid, it was just we were going to get to do this thing. Well, we went there. And we started our show, and I sang the songs the best I could. I thought I sounded pretty good. And the kids came, and the kids went, and it didn't get too exciting right away, and seemed okay. Some of the kids seemed to like me. A bunch of little girls were up front with no shoes on, sitting on the floor, acting like they were real interested. And then in the course of the evening, kids left and came back with their friends. And they left again and came back with their friends. And at the end of the night, they had a full house. They'd never had it before. And they had a rule that was, once a kid came to the sock hop and they paid their dollar to get in, they couldn't leave. If they left, they'd have to pay another dollar to get back in. And the reason was, from what I understand, it was to prevent kids from getting into trouble, from going to the sock hop and sneaking out to drink or sneaking out to smoke or whatever. Now, the interesting thing is, both of those concepts to me in those days, those were foreign ideas. I mean, kids my age didn't go out to drink. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, that was the rules they had at this sock hop. The end of the day, we went to talk to the father, and mostly just to get the $5, and he gave us a 20.
Wow.
Now, this is big time. This is so huge, I'll never forget it. Mind you, my math is terrible. I didn't add it up right. But he gave us a $20 bill, and he told us why. He said it had never happened like that before. The kids liked the band so much that they paid to get in the first time and left, knowing they'd have to pay to get in a second time. They went out, and they called their friends and came back with their friends because they knew their friends wouldn't want to miss this. Some kids paid as many as three times to get into the same show to see us.
That's fantastic, especially considering this was the late 50s, and a dollar then would be like, what, $5, $7 today?
Well, I wish I had some of those dollars then. Yeah, I think you're about right. It would be. It would be somewhere around $5 to $7. And the thing is, it was a gig for $5. That was the whole deal. It was really to pay the gas money. And naturally, the gas money was always more than you needed. But on the other hand, he'd been using the car to get us back and forth to the rehearsals, too. So to get $20 for performing, wow, that was great. And so we went and we ate it. We went to Hojo's and had fried clams and stuff
typical
like that.
Typical teens.
We didn't go home with any money. We weren't supposed to.
After that, were you pretty well determined to do professional gigs, or was that a one-time or every now and again kind of thing still?
Oh, suddenly I had a life. I could be somebody. I wouldn't just be an outsider. And mind you, in this other town where I wasn't an outsider because I was a complete outsider, I was a star.
Wow.
So, that was great. And I decided that that seemed like a really fun thing to do. And I think we had two more gigs, and then the oldest kid got a girlfriend. That was the end of it. There was no more band.
Romance conquers music here.
Oh, God. Well, the rest of us were too young. We didn't have cars. You know, so my first career with the Jesters lasted, I think, 3 gigs. And that's all. But they were great gigs, and they showed me that I could really entertain those kids. They really liked what I was doing, and they came back for more. So, yes, if you say, you know, where did that part start? That's where it started. It started with that little band called the Jesters,
and
back
that
when I was about 14.
Paving the way for some later musical successes. But before that, did you not also have a production, not really a production company, but an animation company?
Well, see, now we mentioned that I had been interested in that, and that's all true. And in fact, my father was a filmmaker, and he had left WNAC-TV by then to form his own company, and he was doing commercials. And here I was studying animation and everything that there was to be known about motion pictures, because obviously I had a big love affair going with the movies. And I, you know, nobody was about to give me a real crew and a real cast and let me direct them. But if I drew the characters, I could make them do whatever I wanted them to. So animation beckoned. I learned how to do animation, and I had the skill to do it. And so I talked to my father, and I said, listen, the next time you're going to get something animated, could I have a crack at it? And his stuff was all professional, and it went out nationwide and all this stuff. And didn't look like that was going to happen, but he had a thing come in, Duncan Yo-Yo, I think everybody remembers that name, but they had this huge rebirth in the, I guess it was the end of the 50s or the early 60s, and they had Barney Akers was the world champion yo-yo player and all this kind of thing, and they invented this thing they called the Shrieking Sonic Satellite Yo-Yo.
I remember that, yeah.
Do you remember that?
I sure do.
I animated that. That was me and my two Latvian friends who were great draftsmen. Anyway, this was the thing. There was going to be a little guy. He holds his hand up and he goes, yo-ho, and there's an echo, yo-ho, and then he goes, yo-yo, yo-yo, and the yo-yo goes up and down, and that's it. It wasn't a big deal. I think it was all of, perhaps a total of 20 seconds of animation, including about a 6-second thing of the yo-yo coming through outer space. No, it's probably less. It was probably no more than 10 seconds of animation. All right. I did it. And I did it so well that he paid me for it, which was basically sort of like, you know, getting the gas money. He paid for the cells I'd used up. But I got that Duncan Yo-Yo national campaign was my animation. The rest of it was live. But the two bits of animation were mine. So again, I had another great career blossoming, or at least it seemed like I did. The trouble was, the only source I had for work in animation was my father, and he didn't do a whole lot of animation. So that was not enough to sustain me. The rock and roll thing, as good as that was, what had become of that was I would go someplace and there would already be a band. And people who knew me would say, oh, you got to let Teddy sing. They called me Teddy in those days. You got to let Teddy sing. And so usually the band would be persuaded, and I'd get up there and sing, and then the lead singer from the band would hate me, and everybody else would have a great time, and that was the end of that. But those two things, animation and music, when I was a kid, those were the things that drove me. And they never really went totally away, did they?
Certainly not. We can certainly see the roots of those in Grumpus and anything like that that we're seeing of your works now. You did have, before we get to the Grumpus production, another band that had every sign of being another Jefferson Starship, or in those days Jefferson Airplane, called Tea Party, a few years after you had been in the Jesters. Would you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was actually a genuine big-time labor of love. I had been in the service in between, and I had performed in Europe. And I went over very well there. As a matter of fact, I had the number one show band in Northern Europe, and they called me The Teddy, Die Twist-Sensation aus USA. Now, the excitement of that is that in those days, there were basically mods and rockers. Now, I know this is going way back, And most of the audience may not remember that, but all you people out there who do remember, you're talking to the real thing now. I'm that old. Anyway, so the mods and rockers. The Beatles represented mods. The Rolling Stones represented rockers. That's how I would break it down. Anyway, I was the teddy. Now, in England, teddy boys were juvenile delinquents. In Germany, they were called Hauptstackers. The same thing, juvenile delinquents. So when I was the teddy, it had all kinds of other connotations. And I did a wild dance show, so they called me the Twist Sensation. You know, twist was the twist it was in. It was big. And since I did a lot of leaping and all that sort of thing, that's what they called me. Well, the band was great over there. And then I had a bad accident. I ended up coming back to this country. And really, it felt like just about the time I had found my wings and I knew what I was going to do. Everything was over, because one of the things that I wouldn't be anymore was the kind of fabulous dancer I had been before the accident. And alone in a hospital full of other wounded people back from Vietnam and all the other things that were going on at that time, it was really tough, because we were all healthy, we were just broken. You don't want to go to orthopedic wards. The guys are ready. They just can't move, you know. So the thing is, the Red Cross came around, and they knew a little bit about my background and my story, because by the time my goods caught up with me, there were posters and stuff, and I would show them to the other guys up and down the ward. So they brought me a guitar. Well, I wasn't a musician then. I was a singer, and I wasn't really a songwriter then either. I had been singing other people's songs up to then. But they brought me a guitar, and it was a terrible guitar, but it was a guitar. And I didn't really have a whole lot to do for that next 6 months while I laid around getting operated on and reassembled. So I taught myself to play. And then to amuse the rest of the troops, I began doing parodies of pop tunes and this kind of thing, just me and the guitar. And then the Red Cross started wheeling me from ward to ward, entertaining all over the hospital. And that led indirectly to my career in the coffee houses in Boston when I got out of the service, and it was from there that I landed the gig as a recording studio manager, and that allowed me to record all of my stuff whenever I wanted to, and also arrange other people's stuff when they came in. So by the end of the day, I ended up with about 80 original tunes, and then it was time to put together a band. And I went out, and I went to the Berklee School of Music, and I found a great guitarist, a really fabulous guitarist. And he played classical guitar that, if you heard him today, he could have been on records. As a matter of fact, he was invited to study with Andre Segovia, and his big conflict at that moment was, should he, you know, quit Berklee and go study with Segovia, or should he finish Berklee? And I came in and said, I got another idea. Join with me. We're going to put together a rock band. So he joined, and then one of the kids, who was the younger brother or something of the original band, heard I was putting the other band, charged over, wanted to join up. He got in on, he found me the other two guys, and the tea party did what we had never done before, which was, it was all original songs. That was the thing we had. That was what we were going to be able to sell, because I wasn't a big-time dancer anymore. But I had fronted for the number one show band in Northern Europe, so I sure knew how. And we went out, and we got off to a pretty good start, and we had moderate success. I guess maybe more than moderate success, some would say. We played all the colleges, and we were a concert band. And we got noticed by television and radio and promoted, and we got a television show. And then strange things happened, and it became time for us to move to California. Now, the strange things weren't bad things. We got a television show with WBZ-TV in Boston and took it. Who wouldn't? It was great. It only lasted 3 shows, and only 2 of them got broadcast. Meanwhile, WRKO, the new call letters in Boston, oh, they'd gone over to rock and roll, and they were going to be number one. Well, they were mad at us because we'd gone to WBZ, so when our records came out, they wouldn't play them. Well, I decided I might as well go to California. There was nothing else going to happen for me back there in Massachusetts. And so I brought the band out here, and this is sort of where we crashed and burned.
And what happened after you crashed and burned with the band? What was your next step career-wise?
Well, I had written all these wonderful songs, by then more than 200, and I had in mind that I couldn't just let it die. There were good songs. We had had fans. We had people who liked what we did. And so I decided to take the best of them and write a musical. In those days, we would have called it a rock opera. And I did, and I worked on it, and all the money I had saved up to then, I spent it, and I got it about half recorded. But it did capture other people's attention, and it led to a career helping other people with their motion picture projects, which, of course, sort of took me full circle and back to where I'd started.
And you would ultimately go on to found your own motion picture company, Otherworld Entertainment?
That's the one.
Founded in 1988. And we're going to fast forward a little bit here because I did promise our listeners that they were going to get a chance to hear a little bit more about Grumpus and actually hear what it is that your audience heard. So would you kind of fast forward for me and take me right to November 1st of 1997. Set the stage. What was going on after you decided, okay, I can't have a name actor because of the cost, and they're all saying, am I crazy anyway? After you chose Blenheim Palace, and after you'd recruited your talent, what was that like, the dawn of November 1st, 1997?
Well, the day was a day that was filled with dread and despair for everybody, except me. I figured, worst case, it'll be like a coffee house routine. We had never had an opportunity to run one single camera rehearsal. The set was still drying. The paint was drying on the steps as the audience was filing into the theater.
Oh my gosh.
The little girls from Coventry had been rehearsing in a church in Coventry. They had their parts down. We'd measured everything so they were working in the right zones. And when we got them down there, we found out that with the camera angles, we had to keep shortening them up and shortening them up. So the only rehearsal we had was we got to rehearse the kids, and I got to run the Fairy Queen, Anna Scott, through her routine up by the dolmen on the stage, which is a megalithic ornamentation, for want of a better explanation. But anyway, it's a big rocky thing. And she got to run through her stuff, and then the audience started coming in, and I couldn't believe it. It was like, we didn't have a lighting rehearsal. We didn't have a run-through with the orchestra. We didn't have a camera rehearsal. But the audience was there, so it must be time for the show. So I was actually quite confident that I had by then learned the entire rhyme. However, everything else was, and what are you going to do when you say this? I was making up all what we call the business as I went along. So it's a good thing I was confident about the rhyme. I had rehearsed it with the characters in mind so that I automatically went into the right character voices. And I had this lovely set built by one of England's really best set designers, so I was very fortunate there. And it had stuff. It was a matter of, okay, well, I can use the rock for the Grumpus' lair. Or I could use it for a table in the provisioner's room. And, it was silly, but it worked. Talk about fortuitous. My DP, who's Peter Anderson and really very well known in the industry, said after the show that he was glad that I hadn't had a chance to rehearse it. He said because the spontaneity of that program was just incredible. And he thought that he said if we had rehearsed it, it might have lost its luster. It might have begun to dry up. We'd be too concerned about the cameras here and the cameras there, and I have to hit a mark. As it was, there were no marks, and I had to hit them anyway, because unknown to me, being an American, we started the show, and the fireworks began from the city of Oxford nearby. I don't know if it was Guy Fawkes or what it was, but for some reason, there were rockets going off. And so we had rockets going off. That would interrupt the show. We would have suddenly a music cue would come up in the middle of a line, and I mean, months earlier when we discussed it, I remembered that we had music cues, but here we were trying to do a show, and what was that noise, and how am I supposed to talk over that? It was a thrill, because the audience was so enraptured by this tale that I think I could have left for 20 minutes and come back, and they would have never moved, not an inch. They just wanted to hear the story. some of them afterwards even said, were we doing something, you know, were we projecting the Grumpus on stage? Because they could be sure. They were sure they could see it. That was clever. How had we done it? And, of course, we hadn't. So I guess it was their own imaginations projecting the Grumpus.
Well, I'm going to ask you right now to project the Grumpus for our radio audience. You're listening to Travis Edward Pike, who is quite possibly America's greatest living storyteller. And, Travis, would you please give us a sample of what the audience heard that evening?
Well, I think first you have to know what is a Grumpus. Now, as the king says, I had thought, said the king, that the Grumpus was a mythical monster of old.
I'm afraid, sire, it's not.
It will have to be fought.
Indeed, if the truth be told, a Grumpus is not like a dragon, rather more like a large, surly cat
with tremendous paws and gigantic claws.
And jaws that can crush armor flat.
They've wide yellow eyes that watch every move.
They live mostly in rocky terrain.
It seems that meat is all they eat. They sneeze when confronted with grain.
They inhabit the coast for the most part.
They are most carefully avoided by men.
According to fable, the beasts are unstable.
Worse when defending a den.
Tawny gold is their normal coloring.
But they turn all to stripes when they're crazed, and then even a knight might resort to flight, for they're a fight, sire, and you'd be amazed.
Just imagine a mad 10-foot tabby, said the king. This does call for our best, and he judged that our sleeping hero was the most qualified for the quest.
Well, Sir Ellery was a fine athlete. He excelled at every sport. King's champion was he, 3 times out of 3. The most formidable knight in the court.
Wow.
And well, that's sort of an introduction. But he's not the only introduction. Now, we've met the king. We've learned a little bit about the Grumpus. But if I'm going to tell you any more about Grumpus, I'm going to have to kind of keep racing in here.
Okay. Would you tell us a little bit more about what happens with Sir Ellery? Give us a little bit of an insight into his character and what he's about.
Well, to do that, you see, we have to learn a little bit more about the Grumpus, too, and I think the Provisioneer would be the right place to go.
Okay.
Now, the Provisioneer was an old, old man, and he read a great deal in the stores, and so he'd become quite learned by simply locking the doors and refusing to answer until he was through with reading the book that he had. He'd studied quite all that there was to be known, so he knew why the Grumpus went mad. And he decides he's going to tell Sir Ellery.
Prevailing winds are from the northwest, and the malady is brought on by grain. So it's on the west coast the Grumpus dwells, for the wind on the central plain blows the grain to the east, which allows the beast to live for a time unaffected. But when, as sometimes does occur, the wind from the east is detected, well, everyone knows that the Grumpus dwells for the most part in rocky terrain and on the west coast, beyond the hills where it's often wont to rain. You see, the mountains do provide a natural barrier to clouds, and dense fog rolling in from the sea often completely shrouds its most plausible natural habitat. Well, my lord, it would seem to appear that if ever a Grumpus was meant to be, it was definitely meant to be here.
But the knight never heard a single word. Lost in a world of his own, he'd already published his memoirs and again stood before the throne, and again several ladies in court had swooned just from seeing him walk through the door, and again an awesome multitude had gathered, and more were coming, and more. And therein lies the rub, dear friends, therein lies the rub. The knight was a great knight. He was a wonderful warrior, and he was a good person. But he was just a bit taken with the ladies. His motivations are quite clear. Now, if I may,
sure.
Have I got time to introduce the Grumpus?
You most certainly have, and I think our audience would like to hear him.
Now, the Grumpus had seen a few humans before and knew that they were an odd lot, but had never before seen one with a shell, or if it had, it forgot. But the sweet scent that had brought it hence of the trout in the shade of the tree overcame its natural caution, so it crept still closer to see. Sir Ellery never so much as blinked, though his horse bolted off in fright, for while our hero slept ever on, the Grumpus inspected the night. The poor beast was vexed, confused, and perplexed by the shell man, a creature quite queer. But the still fresh trout smelled delicious, and the bundle lay so near, it crept still a little bit closer and tentatively stretched out a paw, and since the night dozed contentedly on, unsheathed a long, sharp claw. Ever so gently it hooked the twine with which the bundle was tied, and ever so stealthily pulled it away from the shell man, who snored and sighed.
And, of course, I can just about see the cat, and I'm sure our listeners can, too.
Well, now, the next thing that happens, of course, is there is a confrontation. The knight does have to go after the thing, and he comes up to its den. And he comes up and he bellows, "Monster, come forth and meet your fate. To surrender or death you are doomed, for here stands a knight not afraid of a fight." Well, so great his voice echoed and boomed that even Sir Ellery came to believe that the beast trapped inside was afraid, scared all to bits, frightened out of its wits by his challenge. Still, he stayed outside the dark den, and he bellowed again, "Come forth and surrender or die!" When the echo ceased, the craven beast still dared offer no reply. So the knight hacked a limb from a nearby tree. With a flint he set it aflame. But while Sir Ellery was thus engaged, the Grumpus entered the game. Its wide yellow eyes watched Sir Ellery turn. They stood face to face at last, and the knight, in a fright, dropped his torch at the sight, and thus the moment passed. Then the heat of the torch began to scorch Sir Ellery's armor-clad toe, so he howled, dropped his sword, grabbed his foot, spun around, and hopped quickly away from his foe. Well, the startled Grumpus sniffed at the flame, which singed its whiskers and nose, which made it sneeze, which blew out the torch and compounded Sir Ellery's woes, for now the curious Grumpus advanced to examine the helpless knight, who, though he was armored from head to foot, had no weapons left for a fight. Still as a statue, Sir Ellery stood, but slowly he started to sway, scared half to death. The poor knight held his breath till he fainted dead away.
Poor Sir Ellery, his experiences with the Grumpus are something that any klutzes among us would identify with.
Well, the joy is that he does befriend the Grumpus, and I know you know that, Dot, because I know you've seen the video.
Mm-hmm.
But he befriends the Grumpus, but he never paid attention. He was always a daydreamer. He was always thinking of the end result, and he was a terrible flirt. He really was one for the ladies. So he befriends the Grumpus, he teaches it all that he thinks it needs to know, and he decides to take it back to the king's palace. Well, the trouble is, to do that, he has to walk right through miles and miles of fields of grain. And, of course, the provisioner already told us that that's not good for the Grumpus. The farmers and peasants working the fields were astonished to behold the Grumpus tamely strolling along with our hero, courageous and bold. Some grabbed up their children and fled to their homes, but others were too stunned to run, and frozen in shock, they remained to gawk as Sir Ellery waved to each one. For Sir Ellery, the knight, took particular delight in the idea of being on show, and he took great pride in walking beside the Grumpus, his erstwhile foe. But then, as they passed near a lovely young thing whom the knight might have liked to impress, a suspicious quirk made the cat jerk, the first sign of the creature's distress. Then the Grumpus froze,
rubbed its nose with its toes, and then sneezed with a mighty roar. Well, the girl shrieked and ran. When they're frightened, they can. No, you're not to do that anymore, shouted the knight. Look, you've scared her away. I warn you, it's that sort of thing you must never do. If you only knew, why, if this should get back to the king. Then the knight noticed. The grumpus looked strange. Its nose was all swollen and sore. Its eyes were all red, and it hung its head. And something he'd not seen before, it seemed to be wearing another cat's coat. It had gone all stripes end to end, and its tail snapped and twitched like a thing bewitched, said the knight of the change in his friend. Oh, I say, you do look awful.
And this is too good a story for us to spoil by saying much more other than the cat and the knight kind of get into it on this.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing I would like to say to all
sure.
your listeners is that this is a wonderful adventure story. It's funny and it's frightening. And I don't want to, you know, underplay the fact that sometimes it gets downright scary. We had people in that audience on the edge of their seat. I even had a section that I will not tell you about where the tears were streaming down their cheeks. And I asked them, I said, but you people knew the story. The kids knew the story. How could they be crying? They said they thought I might have changed it. So I guess the magic was working.
I think it did, because what we didn't mention for our audience was that you were actually taping this performance as you were doing a live theatrical thing. It was like a hybrid between a movie and a theatrical performance.
It's as long as a feature film. It's 99 minutes long. And we had to shoot the entire thing in 4 hours.
Wow.
So when you see a show like Tool Time or something like that, and they always play at the end of the show, they'll have the bits where they say, these are the outtakes, and they're fun. They're funny, and everyone enjoys them. Well, they've rehearsed that same show for a week, and they still have outtakes. We had 4 hours to do a 99-minute show, and there was a half-hour intermission in that. So it was an enormous undertaking. It was difficult, but incredibly rewarding, and I would not change a thing about it. But we did start to mention it because sometimes it gets scary, so if you would let me.
Sure.
I want to do it a little bit more.
Sure.
'Twas a gloomy night. And this despite the light from the full moon on high. And the dwarf went to bed with a sense of dread and foreboding he couldn't deny. If the dwarf was asleep when the first howl came, by the second he was wide awake. By the time he heard the mournful third, he'd begun to tremble and shake. For out of the night came a clanking sound, a horrible, ghostly clatter. He tried to be still, but a cold, eerie chill set all his teeth a-chatter. "Who's there?" the dwarf cried, but no answer came save a rattle, a clank, and a moan as closer and clearer and louder and nearer came the horror unseen and unknown. So it's got stuff like that there, ain't it? And then... The knight swallowed his fear, for his duty was clear. Sir Ellery, noble and brave, though filled with dread, rose from his bed and set out to search through the cave. For the knight had given his oath to the king. Before the whole court he had sworn to be worthy of trust, to always be just, to protect the frail and forlorn. And now the whole kingdom was counting on him, no mistaking the king's command. Return at the end of a week and a day with the beast or its head in hand. He came to a cell near the back of the cave, clearly the dwarf's own room, where a lonely candle aglow on a desk barely pierced the oppressive gloom. Still, it gave the brave knight just enough light to take in the cluttered array of parchments and papers and tablets and books, and the bed where the grumpus lay. Then a flash, like a cry, drew Sir Ellery's eye, for while magic may hide a dwarf's hoard, it
could not conceal the cold glint of steel that revealed the knight's broad light sword.
Wow. Well, now that the hair is standing up on my arms...
Isn't it fun?
Oh, it certainly is. And I know that just about every grade school teacher and every librarian in town is going to be saying, well, where can I get a copy?
The easiest way is to just go directly online to www.grumpus.com. That's GRUMPUSS.com.
www.grumpus.com. This is a very fun little website because you also have the verse, some of the verses of Grumpus that you're putting on there.
Some of the verses are there. If you have a good sound card, you can listen to them. You can also read the letter that introduces the show, which was written by Princess Anne. I'm rather proud of that. That's something.
Yes, I should
think so. I'm the only guy on my side of the street who has one of them. And it's also where you can see what the reviews are, and you can actually go to the banquet and meet some of the celebrities that were there. Lynn Redgrave was there. She was wonderful. She was
wow.
So, no, it was quite an affair. Have I got time while we wait for me to tell people about the Dwarfs Library?
Very briefly. We have about 5 minutes left, but we'd love to hear about it.
All right, a little bit of the Dwarfs. I'll do it quickly.
Sure.
Do I dare to believe what my eyes perceive? Never have I seen such treasure. I have silver and gold, new mint and old, but this is wealth beyond measure. Here's a text from the library at Ephesus, Alexandria on the Nile, and Carthage, and Rome. Aye, and closer to home, manuscripts from the Emerald Isle. Hieroglyphic, sire, long-lost alphabets in languages known and obscure. These great tablets were wrought by men who fought round the ancient walled city of Ur. Here are books all the way from the court of Cathay. Sanskrit scrolls from Hinduland. Small tablets from Crete. The Timaeus, complete. Written in Plato's own hand. I've been meaning to read it, the dwarf replied. I never could find the time, said the knight. But I may. Oh, I plan to one day. But I do like books best if they rhyme.
And easy to see what you consider the major treasure here. I always thought that was fun as far as what the king likes when he ultimately comes, as opposed to all the dwarf's treasure, this is what he chooses. So I thought that was really a neat little note in Grumpus.
Well, the other thing that's exciting about the audio that we should mention is the fact that it has a complete wall-to-wall soundtrack. We have all the special effects and sound effects that have the Grumpus, the growling, the snarling, the walking, the horses, the knight, the clanking of the armor, the drawing of the swords, and it's fabulous. It's just a thrill to listen to. The audio speaks to your imagination. You make up the images. You fill in the blanks, like the best of old-time radio. And so it, in some ways, is far more and deliberately engaging to an audience. And, of course, it's great on long trips with the kids when they're sitting in the back saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? You put on Grumpus, it'll shut them up for a while.
Spoken like a true dad. Speaking of which, as the Grumpus performance was going on, where was your daughter Lisa? What was happening?
She was the gal who dressed up in stage black, and she went out there with a copy of the poem, and hiding with a little pen light off to one side, was keeping track of how bad I messed up and whether or not we had to stop and take two steps back and walk into it again. And we did that. We did that. If there was a mistake, there were no marks. It wasn't a rehearsed performance. She'd say, you left something out. I'd say, oh, no, what did I leave out? And she'd tell me. And I'd say, all right, what's the last thing I remember doing clearly? Well, here's where I came down the steps. So I would go back to where I was, start with something we knew was good, and walk back into the place, picking up whatever I had omitted or made a mistake with. And when you see the edited production, it is virtually seamless, isn't it?
It certainly is. In fact, I had to ask you in one of our phone conversations about those outtakes. I didn't see anything go wrong at all.
Well, I guess we did a pretty good job.
You did a fantastic job, and I'm sorry to say that we are just about out of time for today. But, Travis, would you have the time to come back to Beyond the Spotlight?
I'd love to. I would love to.
our listeners never got to hear anything about your odd tales and wonders or your upcoming projects. I think they'd like to. Before we go, please give your website.
The website is www.grumpus.com. Grumpus is G-R-U-M-P-U-S-S, two S's. And most search engines only need to have you type in grumpus.com, and you'll be there. I think you'll enjoy it. Visit everything. You'll have a good time.
Travis, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Dot. It's been a real pleasure.
My guest has been Travis Edward Pike, quite possibly America's greatest living storyteller, in addition to being an artist, musician, poet, producer, and most probably a movie maker again in the future. I'm Dot Cannon. Join me again next time, this time next week, as we go beyond the spotlight.